Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Stuart was more like canine personality, and Fonda had more of a feline personality. Fonda was the cat that walked by himself, and Stuart was happy to be stroked and given these opportunities and given a good salary, and what's the complaint?
Scott Eiman is one of America's premier film historians. He's written 15 books about Hollywood history, three of them New York Times bestsellers, including John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Today we're talking to him about his newest book, Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So you're constantly writing about Hollywood and the studio system, but the friendship between Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart isn't really the most obvious topic. And so I was just wondering how you came to the idea of writing this book.
Out of my 15 books, two were not my idea.
Okay.
The book about Louis B. Mayer and this one.
Yeah.
This was just an out-of-the-blue suggestion from a close friend, John Sackrett Young, who does did China Beach and the West Wing. And went next, and I said, I have no idea. And he said, you know what I've always wanted to read? And that's one of those questions that writers dread, because it's generally just an atrocious idea, but people want to help, you know?
Yeah.
So you listen and you're polite. And he said, I've always wanted to read a book about the friendship between Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart. And there was a beat, and then there was another beat, and I thought, geez, that is a good idea.
Yeah. Nice.
And, you know, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I ended up picking up the check for dinner. The least I could do.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I liked it, for basically one reason. Not only was it a book I hadn't already written, it's a book I've never read.
Right.
And at this stage in the history of 20th century culture, an awful lot of books about the movies have been written. But the idea of a very up-close and personal look about an intimate friendship between two famous movie stars is just, I mean, nowadays movie stars don't have intimate friendships because everybody's a migrant worker. You know, they go and they're in Vancouver or they're in Los Angeles or they're in Tangier. But I mean, everybody's moving around. They're all individual planets circling.
Mm-hmm.
But in, you know, the 30s and 40s, basically you worked in Los Angeles. That was it, you know?
Right.
So you actually could form relationships. And it was kind of on that basis that I thought, yeah, there might very well be something here.
Yeah.
And I pursued it.
Nice. And so, but it's also a book that lets you write about American acting styles, right? Because one of the interesting things that comes up in this book is that both of these men were very firm believers in sort of showing and not telling. And in fact, you have an interesting bit in this book where, you know, we are always giving credit to Marlon Brando for sort of revolutionizing American acting by making it more natural and interrupting people. But really, Jimmy Stewart was the one who did that first, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's just that, you know, that generation of actors, the generation that Stewart and Fonda, they were only 2 years apart in age, so they were basically the same generation. They had an entirely different training and process than post-war actors had, like Brando or Montgomery Clift or Al Pacino and, you know, Brando and all that. And, you know, it was much more in the Spencer Tracy mold. Learn the lines backwards and forwards, look the other actor in the eye, respect the script, otherwise why are you doing it? And it was very building block oriented, you know, and they all tended to follow that. And but some of that generation of actors had such individual personalities. I mean, for instance, Spencer Tracy, who could not seem actorish if you held a gun to his head. He just had this beautiful, natural flow to him. It was like he was talking to you directly. You know, there was nothing of the movie star performance about him.
Yeah.
And Stewart had that speech pattern, that kind of halting speech pattern. If Stewart did a one-act play, it would last 90 minutes, you know? And because he, and that was sincere, I mean, he would extrapolate it, of course, for effect. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he really did talk like that. And it took him, he was kind of circuitous, you know? He was in the Will Rogers mode. He wouldn't just toss off a one-liner. He'd kind of like circle around it and broaden the narrative out. So he had that speech pattern, and because of his manner and because he was so natural, because he was such a one-off, I mean, nope, there was nobody else remotely like Jimmy Stewart in terms of his presentation as an actor. He made even speeches that were kind of theatrical seem very natural and very believable. That if a more formal actor had done the same speech, it wouldn't have been as impressive.
Right, right. And so take us back a little bit to their youth. When how did Fonda and Stewart meet each other?
They met first for a hello, how are you handshake in 1930 at Princeton. Triangle Club, of which Stewart was a member of the dramatic club at Princeton, had hired Margaret Sullivan to come in and do a play. And Fonda was besotted with Sullivan. They'd fallen in love, and basically he didn't want to let her out of his sight, which was probably actually a wise choice given Sullivan. And he followed her to Princeton for her to do this show. And he met Stewart then, and they said hi, and that was the end of it. And then he and Fonda and Sullivan went back to the Cape, where they were working in a theater called the University Players.
Mm-hmm.
Stewart graduated 2 years later with a degree in architecture from Princeton, never practiced. By that time, he was basically a goner for the theater. And Fonda and Sullivan's marriage had broken up, and Fonda was despondent and quit the University Players, and Stewart was recruited to replace Fonda as the young leading man for the University Players. About 6 months later, the University Players went belly up, and Stewart and the rest of the University Players were cast upon the waves of Depression era in New York City. And that's when Stewart and Fonda moved in together, because as just starving young actors in New York, you know, the hotel, they rented a room in a hotel. Josh Logan would come in and out. Burgess Meredith would come in and out. Myron McCormick would come in and out. All these young actors trying to find purchase, you know.
But weren't there some gangsters that came in and out too?
Oh yeah, it was a gangster hangout. It was on the site of where Lincoln Center is now on West 64th.
Oh wow!
And the gangsters would come in looking for girls. And you know, there were no locks, evidently, because they would just open, the gangsters would open the door, walk in, look around, and walk out again.
Because they're gangsters.
You know, Fonda called it Cossack gangrene, because it smelled moldy, you know. And for some unexplained reason that no one could ever figure out, the stove was in the hallway.
Oh, my gosh. And you say they ate a lot of rice.
A lot of rice, a lot of heavy carbs. They went to every art opening they could find, because there's always hors d'oeuvres at art openings. I mean, they were starving young actors. And whoever was working got the bed. And if you weren't working, you got the couch, you know?
Hmm.
And they lived together there for 3 years. Then Fonda went to New York. I mean, Fonda got hired to go into movies in 1935. Stewart stayed behind for about 6 months, and then he got hired by MGM to go out as a young contract player. So they hooked up again and rented a place in Brentwood and moved in together there for 2 more years.
Yeah.
And then Fonda got married for the first time, and that broke them up temporarily. And then after the war, each of them, Stewart, of course, was a B-24 bomber pilot at the Air Force, and Fonda was in naval intelligence in the South Pacific. They came back to Hollywood, and Stewart's house had been rented, and the lease had 6 months to go. So he moved in with Fonda again for the 6 months, and he lived in Jane and Peter Fonda's playhouse.
Right.
Jane and Peter moved into the guest room in the house, and Stewart lived in the playhouse that Fonda had built for his kids.
Right. And so, you know, they eventually each become major Hollywood stars. And you quote Jane Fonda in this book saying that she felt like that Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda were never competitive or really jealous of one another. Do you believe what she said?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. They had the, their friendship was a kind of a safe place for each of them. It was away from the pressures of their families, but especially away from the pressures of show business and the movie business and the attendant neuroses of actors, which is essentially every job is their last job and no one's ever going to hire them again, which is absurd if you think about the stature each of them had. But each of them felt that to a greater or lesser extent. Fonda was a little bit more neurotic about never getting another job. Stewart slightly less, but they both figured that the end was not, their careers were about to end almost any time.
Yeah.
But within their friendship, their hobbies were boys' hobbies. They weren't adult hobbies. They would fly kites. They would build model airplanes, radio-controlled model airplanes, huge, like, 8-foot wingspan things. And they had this, they were like boys' hobbies. And it's I think that's because each of them needed that as a means of escape from the terrible internal pressures that they had as actors and the responsibilities of being huge movie stars and family pressures as well. So it was, each of them was provided an escape hatch for the other.
Yeah.
So I don't think they were jealous at all of each other.
And so,
because they're very different actors. They're very different actors as in terms of their presentation. Stewart's a very emotional actor, at times theatrical, and Fonda is completely contained and kind of isolated, and he's best when he's working in opposition, you know, and he's a subtle, very subtle actor. I think I say in the book that he's the only American actor that could have worked for Yasujirō Ozu, you know, the Japanese director,
right,
where everything is contained. You know, he's a very recessive actor, as opposed to Stewart, who's much more emotional and presentational.
Right, right. But one of the interesting things that I hadn't realized before reading this book is that both of these men, you say, were kind of loners and emotionally aloof. Is that something that you think cemented their friendship? I mean, what do you think they liked so much about one another, besides building model airplanes, I guess?
Besides building model airplanes, neither one asked anything of the other.
Okay.
You know, I asked Stewart's kids if they ever asked their Fonda's second wife, the mother of Jane and Peter Fonda, committed suicide. And I asked Stewart's kids if they'd ever talked to their dad about that experience, you know. And they said that one of the girls, one of his twin daughters, did ask him if they'd ever had a conversation about the death of Francis Fonda. And Stewart said, oh honey, we never talked about that ever. You know, and that was the relationship. Each of them implicitly understood what the other one needed from the relationship, and each of them gave it to them. You know, they had an implicit understanding, and neither of them needed a lot of people in their lives. Fonda more obviously than Stewart, because Stewart was more gregarious and more outwardly a pleasant person. But as Stewart's kids told me, they didn't really have a Beverly Hills upbringing. They could have been raised in Ohio. You know, the only movie people at the Stewart house were Fonda and Lou Wasserman. That was pretty much it. Gary Cooper and he were good friends, but they would go over to Cooper's house. Cooper wouldn't really come to their house, you know?
Yeah.
So the only movie people at the Stewart house were Henry Fonda and Lou Wasserman.
It's amazing. So,
which is not a bad double. If you're going to have a double act, that's probably a pretty good double act
to
have.
Definitely. So both of them were infatuated with the actress Margaret Sullavan. And we have tended to forget about her a little bit today, but she was a really talented actress. Could you explain a little bit about what she was like and why they both fell for her?
Well, she was extremely emotional. She was extremely gifted. She was extremely manipulative. And I don't think either of them had ever encountered a woman quite like that before in their lives, or frankly, ever would again. I think she burned both of them on some deep-seated psychological level. She only made 12 or 13 movies. She didn't like Hollywood at all. She left Hollywood for the last time in 1950, went back to New York, to the theater, and she found that the theater bored her after a while. She didn't like long runs. Well, if you don't like making movies, and if you don't like long runs in the theater, exactly where are you going to work? you know?
Right.
She was very temperamental, and each of them, I think, in their own way, thought they could gentle her, thought they could make her happy, thought they could complete her, as the movie line would have it. And neither one of them could. She ended up committing suicide in 1960 as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Fonda, to see home movies of Fonda when he was with Sullivan in 1929, 1930, that's a different Henry Fonda than we saw, you know, in the movies. He's young, he's gleamingly handsome, and he's incredibly emotional, even in silent home movie footage. He's just besotted with her, clearly. And she's beautiful, but she's not beautiful in an actressy Hollywood way. It's more her personality carried her over the top. And she had this beautiful husky voice. Her best work, I think, is in Lubitsch's Shop Around the Corner.
Yeah,
which she did with Stewart. She was a big fan of Jimmy Stewart, and she helped him with his acting in the early days of his career when he was a little big for the camera.
Yeah.
And she would work with. She made four movies with Stewart. She made one movie with Fonda, who was her ex-husband by that time. But she was very, very, very supportive of Stewart's career, and his letters to her are extremely emotional. Nothing overt is stated. You know, but mm-hmm. between the lines, it's clear he had very deep feelings for her.
Yeah, yeah. So did Marlene Dietrich really call Jimmy Stewart a, quote, mumbling baby-faced beanpole?
Yes, just before she had an affair with him, yes. It was on Destry Rides Again, and, you know, he wasn't her type of actor, but she, you know, as they started working together, she realized that he really did have this strange impact, and she also found him extremely attractive, as many women did, because Stewart had this Midwestern sweetness about him mm-hmm. that was not common in Hollywood at all. So Stewart did very, very well with the ladies in Hollywood. Fonda always insisted Stewart got all the girls. Stewart always insisted Fonda got all the girls. I think Fonda was probably telling the truth. I think Stewart probably did a little bit better with the women than Fonda did.
Huh. So you have an interesting moment in this book that I want to ask you about, because Jimmy Stewart, really throughout his life, it seems like, defended the moguls of the old studio system, mm-hmm. you know, saying mm-hmm. that they weren't really terrible people. You've written a book about Louis B. Mayer. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we could debate whether they were good people or not, but I, you know, it's pretty indisputable that they weren't saints. Why do you think he defended them?
I think he saw it as a classic apprentice system, mm-hmm. which in a sense it was. He's correct in that sense. In other words, they would bring in 30 people a year, you know, 15 or 20 women, 15 or 20 men, and they would give them acting contracts. And then they basically throw them in the deep end of the pool. And they would, you know, give them training, and they'd go to school and give them small parts and see if they came across, if they projected it into the lens onto the screen. And most of them, of course, washed out. But there were always one or two that didn't wash out. And of those one or two per year that didn't wash out, every 5 or 6 years you'd get a Clark Gable or a Jimmy Stewart or a Henry Fonda. And then you've got something that will keep the studio going for 10 or 20 years in extreme cases. So I think Stewart was grateful for the opportunity that they gave him at MGM. Fonda, of course, just saw that he was being ordered around by people he didn't want to be ordered around by, because Stewart was more like a canine personality, and Fonda had more of a feline personality. Fonda was the cat that walked by himself, and Stewart was happy to be stroked and given these opportunities and given a good salary, and what's the complaint? You know, and they never agreed about this. They never agreed about this. They would argue about this to their dying day. Because if Fonda wanted to make his own decisions, and he particularly objected to having to sign a 7-year contract in order to play Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath, which is what Daryl Zanuck made him do. Okay, you want to play Tom Joad for John Ford? Here's the contract. So he signed away the next 7 years of his career. It drove him nuts. He never, ever forgave Zanuck for screwing him to the wall like that. Stewart would happily have signed that contract to play a character that strong for a director that great, you know?
Yeah.
They simply had different attitudes. They simply had different attitudes about being bossed around.
Right, right. So I want to ask you a little bit about the research for this book, because it seems to me, at least, that it's difficult to write about sort of a friendship like this and the emotional lives of people who aren't really that keen on sharing their emotions. In addition to the fact that, you know, the old studio system was very keen on just projecting the image of the stars that they wanted to project. You mentioned that you interviewed Jane Fonda and Peter Fonda and Jimmy Stewart's children. But how do you get around that kind of emotional reticence to create a portrait that's, emotional and engaging?
Well, the kids were very important.
Mm-hmm.
So was Shirley Fonda, Henry's widow, who's still alive.
Okay.
She was about 30 years younger than Henry, and she's in her mid-80s now, but she's doing fine. And Shirley invited me into her house, which is the house she and Henry lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically the house that Fonda left when he died. Nothing really has been changed. His needlepoint pillows are still in the chairs where he left them. His books are still in the library. His paintings are still on the walls where he hung them. So walking through his environment, which has been impeccably preserved, gave me such insight into who he was and how he moved psychologically and emotionally through his life, you know, because this was his environment. This was the environment he constructed piece by piece. He moved there in 63 or 4, and he died in 82. So he was there for almost 20 years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was invaluable. That was invaluable to see the way he lived and how he lived and where he lived.
Right.
And the kid, of course, who saw their parents through two sets of eyes. They saw them as children, and then they also saw them as adults. And in the case of Jane and Peter, they saw both their father and Uncle Jimmy, as they call Stewart, because to this day they don't say Jimmy, they say Uncle Jimmy, you know, because that was his family. That was how the family knew him and understood him. They also saw him as an actor. They saw him subjectively as his godchildren, and they saw him objectively as an older man, as their father's best friend, as Uncle Jimmy, as a world-famous movie star, as a skilled professional. So you get these multifaceted approaches from different people depending upon their own experience of the people. If I hadn't had the kids, if I hadn't had Shirley, if I hadn't had the opportunity for the house, if I hadn't found that cache of oral history stuff at the Library of Congress, I couldn't have attempted the book, frankly.
Yeah.
I wanted the book to be intimate. I wanted the reader to get a genuine feeling for their psychological makeup and their emotional makeup and how they both interacted with each other because of those makeups. And I couldn't have done it without the kids and without the oral histories of the LOC. It would have been impossible. I would have had to just drop the idea.
Yeah. Well, it definitely comes on the cross in the book. Congrats on publishing it. And thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
So two loners who became major Hollywood stars.
I mean, Lord love a good dual biography, right? I love that. Oh, you remember that Elizabeth Taylor, Michael Jackson one that Donald Bogle wrote? I just eat it up. I love to hear about friendships between famous people.
Yeah, it's really, it's a nice narrative strategy for sure. So do you have a favorite old Hollywood star?
Of course, it's gotta be, hands down, Betty Davis.
Yeah.
And I was recently rewatching some interviews with her. She was Johnny Carson's guest very frequently.
Yeah.
And in one particular episode, he asked her, "How would you like to be remembered?" And she said, "As a good worker."
Huh.
And I was totally surprised. And it made me think how I would like to be remembered. And of course, I'd like to be remembered for being very beautiful. How would you like to be remembered, Clay?
As a good worker too. But I think Betty Davis, I mean, the studio system, you know, as you sort of heard in this interview, I mean, they just threw them in and saw if they could do it, you know, and she was a great worker. I don't know if you watched Feud, the series about the rivalry and friendship between Joan Crawford and Betty Davis on
Not
TV,
yet.
But it's a pretty amazing series. I loved it. But I mean, I love anything old Hollywood. So
that was a great interview. And I, and also, he has a great voice.
Yeah, he does have a great voice. I didn't remember that from the previous time when I had talked to him.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So you're going to talk to a younger fiction writer, is that right? Ivy Pachoda?
Yes, but we're going back to California, so.
Nice. Yeah, last week we had our European episode, or I guess this is our California episode.
Hollywood, etc.
That's right.
Picture it, 2010. A sunny LA morning like any other, which means, of course, a traffic jam on the 110. Suddenly, he appears. A mysterious man, running. Weaving in and out between the cars, against traffic, buck naked. His nude maneuvers have various implications for a handful of characters who see him streaking by, and those who'll see the amateur video footage on social media later. Hashtag NakedRunnerLA, hashtag letting it all hang out. With this vibrant scene, Ivy Pachoda's Wonder Valley is off and running. It's a beautifully crafted novel, one that our Kirkus critic calls, in a starred review, absorbing, finely detailed, nasty California noir. Pachoda is the author of The Art of Disappearing and Visitation Street, a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick, among other honors. She lives in Los Angeles, where she teaches creative writing at the LAMP Arts Program in Skid Row, and is a former world-ranked squash player. Welcome, Ivy, to Fully Booked. Thank you very much for joining us today.
And thank you so much for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Now, Wonder Valley is a story that's told in two times, 2010, where the book begins, but you also show a scene set in 2006. So to make it clear for our listeners, you take turns following different characters in different times, and their lives may or may not converge in strange and coincidental ways. What I will say is many of your characters are literally and figuratively on the run. Would you introduce our listeners to a few of them? I was thinking maybe we could start with Brit, for instance?
Of course, yeah. I'd love to talk about Brit. She's often not asked about enough. So
really?
That is my absolute pleasure. So Brit is a former nationally ranked collegiate tennis player who just dropped out of USC. She struggled to sort of conform to the rigors of a college tennis program. She spent so much time being like trained by her parents and coaches as a kid that when she got to college, the structure more structure didn't appeal to her. So she kind of had a bad experience in college, got involved in a not so great situation, which caused her to drop out. And she winds up hitchhiking east from Los Angeles into the desert, where she turns up at a commune run by a sham healer named Patrick. And she's trying to reconcile the things she's running from in LA, her, thwarted tennis career, and, you know, what lies in store for her in the future.
And so Patrick's place out in the desert is Howling Tree Ranch. And he has a lot of acolytes who he terms interns, who are kind of like this very specific type of, I've come to view it as a West Coast person, being from the East Coast and living on the West Coast now. You know, these kind of like dreamy, hippie, looking for meaning in like a rock and a twig kind of groovy people.
Yeah, I don't. It's funny that you consider them super West Coast. I went to a rather hippie summer camp on the East Coast.
Ha.
And there was a very serious element of, you know, back to nature, Quaker belief system, self-sufficiency. But there were also these people who were counselors at the camp who sort of took the vibe and the lingo just, you know, at face value and didn't interrogate it. So that's sort of where those interns came from, were the people at my summer camp who just like would babble on about peace and love all the time without any substance.
Okay. Perhaps not like just like perhaps not West Coast distinct, but be that as it may, we all know the type.
Yeah, Brit is any coast, but you find them. I found you could find them anywhere.
Brit is a much more, in contrast, a much more cynical member of this group.
She sure is. I mean, I grew up playing sports, and there's just no space in a sports environment for any wishy-washiness. You're not, talking about vibes and like currents and, the soul and the spirit. You're talking about winning and you're talking about mastering your emotions and putting, yourself in check and just performing. So she has no time for this sort of behavior out there.
Quote I pulled from a section on Brit is, "At first, Brit resisted the desert's insistent takeover. But when she caught her reflection thrown back at her in the large window of her cabin by the night sky, she felt relief, as if the sand and sun and smells would soon hide herself from herself, building a new person on top of the one she'd been trying to escape."
Yeah, so that's definitely the core of Brit's personality and her conflict in this novel and just in general. Her life until this point has been so dictated by other people, by, this focus on tennis. And she doesn't really know exactly who she is. Everything's been done for her. And then she makes this horrible mistake. It's almost a deadly mistake, but not for somebody else in college. And she's trying to escape that old persona, and she doesn't quite know how to do it. So she's relieved when she sees that this other person is overtaking her physical appearance. So she thinks, so finally I'm becoming myself, because she never really knew exactly who she was because it was defined by other people.
You have another character who I'd like to turn to now named Ren, who similarly had a traumatic event in his past and is in various ways trying to move forward with his life.
He is. So Ren is a character who appeared in my previous novel, Visitation Street, and he was the only person in that novel, the only main character who didn't have a POV, much like Wonder Valley, Visitation Street was told in alternating perspectives. And Ren influenced all the different narrators, but he never was able to talk for reasons that are clear if you read the book. He lives in the shadows and he sort of works in secret. So I really wanted to explore his character more, which is sort of the jumping off point for this novel. It's no secret that he murdered someone in the past when he was a kid. Or doesn't murder, he shot somebody in a accidental gang shootout in the housing project where he grew up in Brooklyn. And like Brit, he's really trying to figure out whether it's possible to make peace with such a traumatic event that you're responsible for, whether you can escape it, whether you can move on from it, or whether it's just so indelibly part of you that you have to carry it with you and have it inform everything you do going forward.
It's really interesting. These are two characters. We're not sure if they will meet, how they will meet, through the course of the book. Both very much on paths of self-discovery. There are two characters, though, that you introduce that, immediately grab the reader's attention and seem more fearsome. And they are Sam and Blake. I don't know how much you want to tell about them.
Oh, sure. I mean, I can tell who they are. Maybe not what happened to them. Sam and Blake are maybe the two most fun characters I've ever created in my not extensively long writing career, but I absolutely love writing them. They're criminals. They're on the run, but they're always on the run. They're always, in trouble with the law or, hiding out. And currently they find themselves holed up in a cabin in Wonder Valley, which is sort of an unincorporated community in the desert, just east of Joshua Tree. And they're living in a cabin. But the cool thing about Sam and Blake is that they're best friends, and they're not obviously lovers, sexual lovers, but they love each other. And I really just, I'm so taken with the idea that, criminals are people too, and they have friendships too. And the criminal aspect of their characters is so much less important to me than this really deep friendship, which is tested when Sam gets very badly injured. He breaks his leg in the opening chapter. And so the way that their friendship is sort of tested by how they both cope with this injury.
One of the ways in which Sam, who's the injured party, copes with his injury is by, what does he do, draw a Milagro?
Yes, he does.
And so, would you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, so Sam is Well, he claims to be Samoan, but he's not. He's actually from Mexico, but from an indigenous religion that's not Christian, like an old. So he's in one of the folk tales of like northern Mexico, is where his family comes from. So he comes from this sort of Indian. I'm not sure exactly. He comes from a family in the Sonoran Desert that's very taken by folk tales and mythology. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
And he really believes in the power of healing and in various types of magic. And when he gets mad at Blake for not helping him with his injury, they can't go to a hospital because they're on the run. What he does is he draws a milagro, which is a sort of wishing picture. So he paints with coal or charcoal on a piece of wood a picture of his leg healed. So he becomes sort of something he can pray to, or some kind of like magical object which he believes will heal his leg, among other odd beliefs Sam has.
It was just one of the many magical objects. There's a lot of instances of prayer in this book among the characters. There are many magical objects or talismans. I had to look up how to pluralize that. I thought it was men. And that seems to be running throughout the book. Why was that of interest for you to write about?
I never really thought about it as a specific choice, but I do, you know, I guess one of the things that has always interested me when I was playing squash, and I'm much more like Brit than I am like a traditional athlete. I always had trouble with focus, and I always had trouble with, magical thinking. I always relied on magical thinking to help me through matches, which is a terrible idea because it does not work. So talismanic objects have always held a huge importance to me, like, you know, or just ritualistic behavior. So I think that in this book, where everyone is on the run or is trying to come to terms with something or is wishing very badly for something to come to pass, talismanic objects were just a complete, a perfect manifestation of that desire. So no one can, the desert also just speaks to that so clearly. It's just filled of omens and signs and a place where, you know, you would just rely on, you know, found objects to impart hidden meanings. So everyone's searching for redemption or explanation. So they sort of turn to objects to give themselves some kind of like answers that they aren't getting from, you know, the natural, normal world.
Another thing characters seem to turn to on the path to redemption, or at least express as a one possibility, is this idea that you can trace your life back all the way back like a little thread to the one event where it went wrong.
Yeah. So that really started with when I was exploring Britt's character and just thinking about what her issue was playing tennis, and why she quit, and why she and what her struggles were on court. And I always have this sense that when you play or compete in a sporting event, there's always one mistake, one error, one false start that sets in motion a disastrous outcome. So, you know, what would have happened if you hadn't hit that first serve or that second, the first serve of the match into the net? Would the match have gone wrong? Was that, you know, what error was it that turned the match on its head? And after I started thinking about that, because it's something I always thought about my own competitive, you know, experience, and if I hadn't done that, would this have worked out differently? And then I said, well, if Ren, when he was 12, hadn't pulled that trigger on a dare and that bullet hadn't found that random passerby, his life would have been different. So when I started to think about, you know, Brit's tennis and Ren's past, it suddenly occurred to me that every character in this book who has sort of gone off the rails psychologically, but gone off like the course, their lives have been derailed, I should say. There has to be an initial moment, one action that if they hadn't done that specific thing, perhaps everything would have worked out differently.
I think so far we've done a really good job of talking about this book without giving away without any spoilers. I'm proud of us, because so much of like the divine reading experience relies on all of the surprises you've laid for us along the way. So
it is hard to talk about, you know, any book with sort of an intricate plot and an element of mystery or crime without giving too much away, especially because there's so many plot lines. There's so many things that do happen, you know, isn't just one reveal.
So I think we've given enough to whet the appetite. So I would like to end with what I believe to be a safe question. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what is the LAMP Arts program and what's your work with that program like?
Sure. That's a very safe question and something okay. I love talking about.
Right.
LAMP Arts program is a studio, a multi-platform art studio and music studio in Skid Row in Los Angeles. And I've teach creative writing there. I've done that for 4 or 5 years now. And LAMP is believes that art and music is a human right regardless of your financial situation or your, you know, mental health, and that everyone should have access to the arts. And it's an important, not just an important way to heal and the way to, you know, work through troubled times, but just something that is essential to everybody to satisfy the, you know, to satisfy their human condition. So mm-hmm. LAMP is open to people in extreme poverty or people struggling with mental illness who have either struggled, who either have been formerly homeless, are currently homeless, or who are just in a situation where they need to have social services. And we produce something called Skid Row Zine, which is a zine, which a homemade, handmade magazine that features the writing and some of the art from the studio. And we take it to various zine fests and we sell it, and it's available for donations. And it's a really great program. I love it, and I love the artists and the writers who come to our workshops every week. I mean, they go, but there's different programs every day. The studio is open every day. So I'm only there once a week, but there's art, music, yoga, and really seriously talented people are participating. And some of the studio participants are now teaching the classes. So it's just wow. become a great self-sustaining program.
That's so cool, because I think in hearing you speak about that, and also hearing what you had to say earlier about Blake and Sam, you know, and dignifying those characters, even though they may be criminals, with, you know, like the full, you know, in telling their story with the same attention and compassion as any of the other characters. I mean, that's important. We all have stories to tell.
And absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, you know, for every person who participates in the workshop or in the arts program, they sort of have had the same experience that many of my characters have, which is a single misstep has sent their lives careening somewhat off course. And the LAMP Arts program is really providing a platform and a place for people to start to get their lives back together and to express themselves creatively. So it all sort of links back to, it all links together.
Well, I thank you for expressing yourself creatively with us today on Fully Booked. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about the novel or your work?
I don't think so. I think we've covered the novel without giving too much away. It was a real trip to get to write a book about Los Angeles, being a Brooklyn native, and I'm so excited that the response has been positive, especially from the Los Angeles community, who can be tough.
I'm excited for you. The book is Wonder Valley. Thank you again, Ivy, for joining us on Fully Booked.
You're so welcome. Thank you, Megan.
So, hippies in the desert. Wow.
Yeah, it's the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
That's right.
It's a really, there's so much more I want to say about the book, but can't, because it, as we described, it is so intricately plotted.
Yeah, yeah.
But really exciting read.
And that's a wonderful program that she volunteers for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Should we bring the editors on to the podcast?
Let's do it.
It's that time of the episode when we ask our senior editors to stop editing and join us on the podcast. So we've got our nonfiction editor, Eric Liebetrau, our children's and teen editor, Vicky Smith, and our fiction editor, Laurie Muchnick. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, Eric, I'm going to ask you directly to stop editing right now.
I just stopped.
Thank you very much, because
no
this
problem.
Is an especially exciting edition of Buy It, Skip It, I hope, for you, because you don't have to come up with a Buy It, Skip It, because we are slated to discuss the best books of 2017 in nonfiction.
That's right.
You excited?
I am not going to tell you to skip anything, which is nice.
What a relief.
It's a relief.
So, I'm really excited to hear your picks.
Well, I'm actually going to focus just on two books. I've discussed a lot of these books during the course of the year and written about them quite a bit. And obviously, you'd be able to go to our website and look at all 100 of them. We have a great list across a wide variety of subjects. And I think if you can't find a book to like on that, then you don't like reading. So there's plenty to choose from, and I'm going to focus on two that are about mental illness. A nice light topic for our discussion today. So I think these are actually two of my favorite books about mental illness that I've read in the past probably couple years. And the first one is called Gorilla and the Bird, a memoir. It's by Zach McDermott. And this one is interesting. Specifically, the author suffers from bipolar disorder. And so it's a great firsthand look at that. But he's also has served on and off when his illness has allowed as a public defender in Brooklyn. So he's kind of sees a lot of emotionally disturbed people during that in his job as a public defender. So he's kind of seeing both sides. A reviewer says somebody who's spent time on both sides of the door. So it's kind of a good mix of that. And there's also, he's the gorilla. And in this story, his mom is the bird. And she's actually the one who does a lot of the fighting on his behalf when he's in and out of various mental health facilities, including Bellevue. She's the one who's keeps him straight, keeps him as well as he can be, and advocates for him when she feels that things aren't going right for him in these facilities. And it's just a really, really well-written, very powerful tale of madness and self-destruction, but also redemption through family, through the dedication of a mother.
Is that book published by Little Brown?
Yes, it is.
Okay, cool. I think I have a copy, and I will definitely be reading that over winter break.
Yeah, it came out at the end of September. And I think our reviewer has a great last line about it. He said, if the Joads were tanked up on Bud Light and Haldol and Steinbeck were under Hunter S. Thompson's influence, this might be the result. Rueful, funny, and utterly authentic.
Can we give it up for our reviewers, please?
That's a good one.
That's a beautiful encapsulation. Okay, so what's your second pick?
So the second pick is, this is a book that we did discuss, but I wanted to bring it up again. It's No One Cares About Crazy People by Ron Powers.
Happy to hear you say that.
Yeah, I think you and I discussed this. The subtitle is The Chaos and Heartbreak of Mental Health in America. And again, this has a really excellent personal dimension because the author, a Pulitzer Prize winner, he's got two sagas going on in this. There's kind of his running indictment of the mental health care in the U.S. and the story of not one but two schizophrenic sons. One of whom tragically hanged himself just before his 21st birthday. And then after that, the author found out that his other child was displaying signs of schizophrenia as well and suffers from a few psychotic breaks. And it's just it's a perfect interweaving of those two threads. He it's extremely personal, but he's also a reporter. So he digs deep into the problems we have treating mental health in this country and not really giving it the attention I think it deserves. And in a lot of cases, as the title says, no one cares about crazy people. It seems that we just write these people off when what they really need is our help. And I think this book is, if you want to understand more about that personal dimension, I think this is a great one to start with.
This book will make you care.
It will make you care. Yeah. I mean, it grabs you from the first couple of pages, and it's, you know, as tragic and, you know, poignant as it is, it's also very readable, and it brings up a lot of great points that I think need to continue to be in the discussion.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Eric, for those two topics.
And Vicky, we announced your picks of the best teen books last week. We released that list on our website last week, and you talked about it with us a little bit last week, but your enthusiasm for YA continues unabated, and you want to keep talking about it, right?
And talking and talking. But there's actually a thematic link with this week, because I wanted to talk about a couple of the best works of nonfiction for teens. I think that there isn't a whole lot of volume in terms of nonfiction for teens that's not directly sort of created for the school and library market. But there is, when literary nonfiction for teens comes out, it is superlative. And the two books that I want to talk about today are books that treat teenagers as completely intelligent, discerning readers who don't need to be coddled, I should say. One is Eyes of the World, Robert Capa, Gerda Taro, and the Invention of Modern Photojournalism by Mark Aronson and Marina Butos. And it's about Capa and Taro, and they were Jewish refugees who sort of pioneered photojournalism during the Spanish Civil War. And the book is not just a biography of the two, but it also goes into the what was going on contextually, historically in Europe that created the Spanish Civil War. It talks about issues about journalists covering war, what's the difference between photojournalism and propaganda. And it's stellar. And one of the things that I would really encourage adults to look at it for is that it is beautifully designed. So many works of nonfiction for adult kind of aren't so visual. And that's where I think YA books really excel in nonfiction. So on every page, there are illustrations, obviously lots and lots of the subjects, photographs. They are captioned intelligently that in a way that adds information. I mean, it's just from beginning to end, a superlative work.
Great.
And the other is also visually fabulous. It is Vincent and Theo by Deborah Heiligman. It's about Vincent and Theo Van Gogh. And like the Aronson and Butos book, it is a biography of two people, but it also is fabulous at contextualizing their lives and also in bringing in all sorts of information about art criticism. So she will at one point be talking about events in their lives, and then she will go into a really intelligent exegesis of one of Van Gogh's paintings. So, I mean, it's really an art lesson as well as a history of the two brothers.
Okay.
It is also beautiful. It's got some color reproductions, but it's also divided into sections that are introduced by black and white sketches of Van Gogh that really set the mood both visually and textually. She sort of changes the way she writes from section to section based on the mood that the characters are experiencing. It's tremendous. Any adult who likes nonfiction would not feel at all that they are reading anything that's dumbed down if they were to choose one of these two books.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for letting us know about that, because you're right, YA nonfiction does tend to get a little the neglected stepchild, I guess.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the time.
Yeah.
We now return you to our regularly scheduled Buy It, Skip It with fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Hi, Lori.
Hey, Megan. Well, I have to admit that it's not exactly the regularly scheduled Buy It, Skip It, because the Buy It that I'm going to recommend highly is not actually a bestseller yet, I hope. At this time of year, so few books come out. You know, everybody wants to get their books on the shelves in time for people to buy them before the holidays. There isn't really much new on the bestseller list to recommend. So in the spirit of the best books of the year still, I just picked a book that is on our best books of the year list and just came out a couple weeks ago.
All right.
It's called Mrs. Caliban by Rachel Ingalls. And actually, there's another actually. It first came out in 1982, and this is a reissue of a...
I first came out in 1982.
What a coincidence. So this is just an amazing book. I'll read you the first line of the review because it completely captures it. A lonely housewife gets a new lease on life in the strong green arms of a sea monster. So what could be better than that? Just this lovely, you know, housewife, Dorothy Caliban, kind of putters around her house. She and her husband, you know, living pretty much separate lives. They've had some tragedies. She had a miscarriage and a young child died. Her husband goes off to work in the morning and just says, I'm going to be late tonight, and doesn't even bother to come up with an excuse. You know, they're just living totally separate lives. And then she hears on the radio one morning an alert that a big green monster has escaped from an oceanographic institute and he's dangerous and people should be on the lookout for him. And a little while later, this green thing steps into her kitchen and is just standing there, and they look at each other and she doesn't know what to do. So she offers him a piece of celery and he eats it and he's so grateful. And he says, help me, I'm in trouble. They'll kill me. I have suffered so much already. And they just become friends, and then they become more than friends. And he lives in her spare room, and her husband is so in his own world that he doesn't even notice that his wife has this big green lover living in the back bedroom.
I mean, the number of times I've heard that story.
So, Lori, the question is, would you call the Caliban's relationship tempestuous?
No, it's not at all. Well, Yeah, ha ha ha.
Sorry.
Sorry, it took me a second because no, it's not tempestuous, but yes, that is a good illusion.
This is the most pun I've had on Buy It, Skip It.
Yeah. So anyway, just buy this book. It's really short. You'll read it so quickly, and it's just so much fun.
It is a great book.
Okay, so moving on to Skip It, Please. What's it going to be?
Well, this week, again, as often, it pains me to have to unrecommend a book by an author I like, Michael Connelly, whose new book is called Two Kinds of Truth. And it features Harry Bosch, his hard-boiled LA police detective, who's just, you know, a great character. But in this book, Harry, 30 years ago, a case that he worked as a LA PD detective, sent a man to jail for rape and murder. And now it turns out that maybe he didn't do it. There's some new DNA evidence, and he has filed a plea of habeas corpus, and he's trying to get out of jail. So Harry has 9 days to prove that this guy really did it 30 years ago. But meanwhile, at the same time, Harry is doing some freelance work for the San Fernando Police Department, because once again, he's been kicked off the LAPD, which tends to happen to him in the course of this series. And he's working undercover as an opioid addict to try to break up a fraudulent prescription ring. So basically, there's just too much going on, two totally unrelated cases jammed together. The whole second half of the book is like a lot of loose ends that don't have much impact being tied up. So, you know, if you like Harry a lot, you know, he's here, but it's not a terrific book.
Good to know. And thank you for that.
Womp,
you're welcome.
All right. Thank you all. And we hope you join us next week. There are, unfortunately, every year, books that are excellent and great reads and get overlooked. And we want to give a little love to those books. And so the December 19th episode will be our episode about the most overlooked books of the year. So we hope you join us then. As for now, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Podcast One has new shows on our new app. Check out all the cool features to help you explore our exciting new programming, like America's Lakers Podcast with Jay Moore, Sessions with Randy Jackson, So Random with Corinne Olympios, Attack Each Day, The Harbaugh's Podcast, Not Just Sports with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen, and Sound of Success, The Dick Enberg Podcast, as well as your old favorites like The Lady Gang, Steve Austin, Shaquille O'Neal, and Adam Carolla. Get the new Podcast One app in the App Store, Google Play, or PodcastOne.com.